Welcome to Ecogradia, where we meet experts and practitioners at the front lines of sustainable architecture and urbanism. My name is Nirmal Kishnani. I'm a sustainable design strategist, author, and educator based in Singapore. This is the second webinar of a limited series organized in collaboration with the Holcim Foundation for Sustainable Construction. This series provides a unique opportunity to explore the designs that were prized at the Holcim Awards 2023, which were revealed in Venice last November. Each month, two award winners will let us in on the making of the projects that earned them the acclaim of the juries and share how sustainability is achieved in their part of the world. Today, I'm pleased to welcome representatives of the teams that received top honors for the Asia-Pacific region. Su Tian Tian is an architect with DNA Design and Architecture. She will be talking about the Fujian Tulo in China, a conservation and adaptive reuse project for which she won the Gold Award. Joshua Bolcheva is director of the District Development Unit in Hong Kong. He'll be talking about Gare Plugin 3.0 in Mongolia, a housing prototype in Ulaanbaatar, for which he and his team won the Silver Award. This webinar series is sponsored by the Holcim Foundation for Sustainable Construction. The foundation was created in 2003 to empower a community of future makers through the transfer of ideas, knowledge, and real-world solutions. The Holcim Foundation today delivers on all these fronts with a treasure trove of information on its website. You can find all past winners of the Holcim Awards from all over the world and discover the strategies they followed on their journey towards sustainability. Go to holcimfoundation.org to find out more. So Tian Tian, Joshua, it's a great pleasure to meet you. The question that we will explore today through your respective projects is how the past informs the present and the future. Now, history, of course, offers us artifacts that connect us to our memories, to identities, to worldviews. History also shows us how to build in ways that are low impact. You're an architect, Tian Tian, with DNA Design and Architecture in Beijing, China. Your project, Fujian Tulo, restores heritage structures called the Tulo, a traditional building typology in the mountain valleys of China's Fujian province. In awarding it the gold for Asia-Pacific at the Holcim Awards 2023, the jury had this to say: "This design project is an exemplary model for building conservation initiatives. Jury was particularly valued the project's in advocating a re-evaluation of existing vernacular structures, favoring repurposing over demolition." Joshua, you are the director of District Development Unit in Hong Kong. Your team's project, Gare Plugin 3.0, is in Ulaanbaatar, Mongolia. A gare is a traditional felt tent dwelling that you have upgraded to provide affordable and energy-efficient housing. In awarding it the Silver Prize for Asia Pacific, the jury had this to say: "The architect's innovation is noteworthy. The project takes into consideration not only the architectural and energy efficiency aspects, but also the well-being of the occupants, truly demonstrating dedication to holistic sustainability." So before we start the conversation, please walk me through your respective projects. Let's start with you, Tian Tian.
Sure. Nirmal, just like you mentioned, Fujian Tulo is very specific vernacular building typology. It was originally built as both collective housing and defense structure for hundreds of people living together and fighting together against enemies. Although 46 Tulo buildings were inscribed as World Cultural Heritage by UNESCO in year 2008, there are still thousands of Tulo buildings in this region and eventually left vacant and abandoned as villagers were moving out of the Tulo by building their single family houses with the economic development in the past decades. So our Fujian Tulo adaptive reuse project is to provide a social strategy for such a social architectural issue or urgency by taking seven Tulo buildings as model examples to reintroduce a new public cultural program as the community center according to the village context and heritage. As a social strategy, I want to mention specifically that the economic measurement is that we are not rebuilding all the ruins, but rather taking the ruin as the new typology to add in new layers of courtyards, gardens, or lookout terraces. So the adaptive reuse of these abandoned Tulou buildings will restore the identity and collective memory and provide new community facilities. In other words, this abandoned vernacular typology can still be performative in our contemporary context. Thank you.
Beautiful. Thank you, Tian. Joshua, would you take us through your project, please?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. So for thousands of years, nomadic Mongolians have lived in Gez, circular structures made of timber, felt, and canvas that are ideal for movable life on the steppe. However, since 1990, due to major political, social, and climatic upheaval, hundreds of thousands of people have abandoned nomadic life and have moved to the country's capital of Ulaanbaatar. So when people move to the city, they're faced with issues that they've never previously encountered in rural life. They have to collect drinking water, they live in close proximity to strangers, and each family household burns around 4 tons of coal each winter just to stay warm. The gers, which are cheap, prefabricated, and readily available, have actually exacerbated the extraordinary growth of the city, which has grown 35 times its size in the last 30 years. So it became clear to us that the very qualities of the ger that has as a nomadic structure were actually contributing to unsustainable urban growth, which became detrimental to the health and well-being of those that lived there. In order to change the direction of urban transformation towards more resilient and sustainable growth models, we set out to change the ger itself. And this is what the ger plugin 3.0 is. It's an adaptation and evolution of the traditional ger. It provides the ger with everything it doesn't have. It improves its thermal performance and offers new spatial organizations of dwelling to meet the demands of its residents. We see the project as an experiment in typological change, to change the very building blocks of the city. And such a process demands testing, demands iteration and invention. And we maintain this approach and ambition in all of our projects in emerging regions which are immersed in the challenges of rapid urbanization. Thank you.
Thank you, Joshua. It's interesting. You talked about the ger and the redevelopment of the ger idea as building blocks of a future city. Tian, you talked about, you know, the two lows as a kind of points of acupuncture within existing settlements, both in a sort of implicit way are trying to deal with the idea of settlements just as a different starting point. But let's take a step back and ask the question, what are the complexities of working with old structures or old methods of construction? Tian, would you like to start?
I want by saying that first of all, the traditional buildings or constructions that carries with the collective memory of how people living on this place, this very specific place for over 1,000 years. So in a way, it's also a identity for this rural region. And at the same time, you know, with the economic measurements, we also wanted to say that it's probably the best, the most economic strategy to look into existing building method, building material, building techniques, and also to work, collaborate with the local community, local skilled workers. Well, actually, most of the villages are skilled builders in this region. So in a way, it's a social, cultural, and also economic strategy for us.
So there is an element of the memory of making, of kind of reviving old crafts and skills. With the ger, interestingly, there was already a problem in the way things were done in the old ways. I mean, they were not very energy efficient, minus 30 degrees, and you know, you're living in a tented structure. I'm just wondering, was that a different type of constraint of history?
I think it's very different as a nomadic culture. So the tent is and the ger is perfect for being a nomad. So when you're having to move along with your herd to different pastures, then it's a great structure to be able to pack away and move in that instance. It's also, they have a stove in the middle of the ger, right, for the heating. And if you're a herder, then you use the dung of your animals. So it's a completely kind of sustainable system in that way. So of course, the challenge is really that change from being nomadic to then being urban and sedentary. So the GER doesn't perform in the same way anymore. So that was really the starting point. Also, what became really interesting for us was that despite all the urban transformation happening, people are building houses around the GERs as they get these plots in the city. However, people still retained their GER. They didn't get rid of their GER even if they'd built a house. So there was still something that was important and relevant that was being used by all the families in the city itself. So our real starting point was to say, okay, how do we address what's not working when the GER itself becomes sedentary in the city?
Mm. Can you elaborate on that? Because, I mean, both your projects look to this idea of a kind of a deficit in traditional structures, you know, as opportunities actually for intervention. So maybe starting with the GER, what was specifically the deficit of the GER and how did your proposal kind of counter that?
So I think, of course, it doesn't have any infrastructure at all. So there's no piped water, there's no shower, there's no septic tank. So people were, you know, acquiring a plot of land in the city, they were placing their GER and then digging a hole as a pit latrine. So there's no infrastructure. And the city is having to build what is effectively kind of petrol stations for water, what they call these kind of water stations, and people have to collect water in order to fulfill all their drinking water and cooking needs. So it doesn't make sense anymore. The lifestyle where you could collect your dung for heating, you could collect your water in the nearby stream, no longer made sense in the city. So it's actually trying to address these kind of basic necessary aspects of living and habitation that didn't make sense anymore in terms of urban life.
Just to elaborate on that, so why retain the GER?
Because I think it's the one thing that everyone still owns. It's the one thing that is still relevant and people are still using it practically in part as part of their daily lives. It's also the cheapest form of inhabitation. So there is nothing that is more affordable than the GER. So we can see that, as I sort of explained, it's like it's part and parcel of the problem. Because it's so cheap, because it's prefabricated, this has created the degree and extent and speed of that urbanization process. So part of what we're doing and part of the strategy, which isn't just the GER plugin itself, but it's part of an incremental urban strategy that begins to consolidate and densify the urban fabric towards a more sustainable objective, I would say.
I mean, cost is very often a consideration for any project, but in particular for adaptive reuse projects or projects that are kind of trying to retain traditional methods or technologies or typologies, because presumably in many cases, it's cheaper just to rebuild, but not always the best solution. Now, in the case of the Tulo, how does the adaptive reuse compare with new structure in terms of cost?
Well, first of all, it has to be very economic strategy because there's thousands of abandoned Tulo. So we're not just working with one Tulo or a few, but it has to be to set up a model example or as a social strategy, so can be scaled up in this way. And the issue is because, you know, on one hand, villagers moved out of the Tulo buildings because they want to have a better single family house for the better living conditions. So it's similar discussion with the GER that thousands of Tulos were abandoned and also under discussion to be demolished. A lot of the local people say maybe we don't need the Tulo anymore. Maybe we can demolish these Tulo buildings. But then on the other hand, it was also a very it's a collective memory. It's also the heritage, architectural heritage carries with the collective memory and local identity. So it was always an issue, a debate for the local community with the local governments. what to do with these thousands of abandoned tulos, and they eventually they just become ruins, you know, when the typhoon comes, when there's a rain or heavy weather, then a few tulo will collapse in such weather. So we definitely see this as the urgency. It's not just a design of a very artistic design, but rather practical solution for such an urgency. The most economic way, it has to be, you know, to engage the local community collaboration and also to engage with the economic strategy. So instead of rebuilding everything into original condition, which will cost massive funding, the idea is that we can take the ruin as new typology, but we preserve the existing leftover structure, and the ruin can just leave it as a new open space when the tulo are converted into the new community or public facilities. So this will require less investment, but at the same time, maybe in one day when we have enough funding, we can rebuild everything, you know, but that would go to another discussion.
Mm. But just to clarify, Namal, if you don't mind, I think it's quite interesting, the difference, because I think in the tulo, they're abandoned structures, right? They're almost like, they've become obsolescent as a vernacular structure. In the Gers case, it's still very relevant. It's not abandoned at all. It's absolutely part and parcel of everyday life. Whether you have money to build a new house or not, you still have a Ger. So its cultural significance and identity that relates to a kind of Mongolian culture has not been forgotten. So it's a very different kind of two sides of the
it's a living tradition. It's
conversation, yeah. I think, about heritage.
I just like you to sort of put some specific program to this, each of you. So Tian, for instance, what is the rehabilitated tulo used for? I mean, you talk about acupuncture points with a social strategy. What exactly are the programs that go into this? What do these rural communities need?
So you see that these tulo buildings are actually quite a large scale structure, right? And they were, they used to accommodate hundreds of people living here. And now even without the original functionalities, we want to make the argument that these large scale structure can be easily converted into a public a space to accommodate community activities and also as a meeting point for villagers and visitors. Then it becomes the acupunctural strategy that each tulo has to be examined according to its current condition and also related back to the village heritage, tradition, culture. A specific public program is introduced to each tulo, really tailored to its own context. So we're not doing, you know, by converting tulo into hotel facilities, but rather a community program like a tulo library, tulo study house, or in another case, a tulo Rem Earth Cultural Center, according to its the village history. So this is what we call acupuncture. It has to be very careful, almost more sensitive to the cultural context, but also to the physical current condition of each abandoned tulo.
Mm. Also the needs of the community around it, obviously.
Exactly. So
deciding whether you put a library in there or something else is contingent on what's happening around it, and otherwise it wouldn't be successful acupuncture, right?
Exactly.
What about the Ger, Joshua? I know it's a living space, but then you have this incremental strategy whereby it grows. Can you kind of paint a picture of what it looks like in its different stages of growth so we understand how this kind of corresponds with the social strategy?
Yeah, absolutely. So one thing we observed in our research was that people were building their new houses incrementally. Of course, they build it when they can afford to build it, starting with the ground, the floor, the foundation, the walls, and building it up over time as they can afford it. So we were thinking, well, this is a key strategy that we need to embrace and become and integrate as part of what we were thinking about. So the ger itself is the life of the entire family. So it's where people sleep, they cook, they do study, everything. It's one household for everyone. And I guess as people have been sedentary since, you know, obviously 1990, there are generations, new generations who are ger district dwellers. So they were never nomads. So they have slightly different demands on how they see their urban future and their household development. So first of all, they want to get the infrastructure. They want to be connected to have a toilet where they don't have inside, so they don't have to go outside to use the toilet when it's minus 30, the starting point. So then to have a shower so that you can, you know, wash when you need to. Then we embedded it with a boiler heating system. So to provide it with a heating system whereby people wouldn't have to burn these 4 tons of coal each winter to stay warm, more efficient system. We then moved the coal burning stove from the center of the ger into this kind of infrastructural core. So our first stage is really that infrastructural core, which acts as a wall that has an element that then connects to the ger. So it was really about the first stage was enabling that connection, which works with the structure, the vernacular structure of the ger, to connect to this new building block. Then over time, if people have sufficient money, they then can expand the house from that infrastructural wall to incorporate an additional living space and also a loft space. So what we found is also that people lived in close proximity to their family structure, their grandparents, their brothers-in-law, etc., etc. So this way they could live in a different way. The ger could be used for their grandparents, the kids could sleep in the loft, and the parents could sleep in the main room. So it enabled different forms of household structure to accommodate or to be accommodated in this new dwelling unit.
Hmm. I'm really intrigued by this idea of a kind of a time-based incremental approach to design, wherein the prototype is seen as a set of parts that you kind of incrementally add to, and obviously that accommodates the growth. I'm just wondering, Tian, in the case of the Tulo, if say 50 years from now they don't need a library, how adaptable is it in the future? I mean, you've adapted it from a past use to something today. How does that longevity continue? What do you do to ensure that?
You know, this goes back to the first question you mentioned, the complexity of traditional building construction on techniques. So this timber tenant and mortise is a traditional assembly timber structure. It's easily to be readjusted. So it means that it could be really a flexible space. It could accommodate different types of public programs. Or maybe in the long term, if the local villagers are willing to convert it back to housing, it would also be possible.
Mm. Well, that's interesting. A lot of the people I talk to when we're discussing traditional typologies or structures or methodologies tend to equate that with being sustainable. You know, there's almost like an assumption that somehow older ways are more sustainable. Is that true? Were there aspects of what you found about history that really had to be abandoned because they were not sustainable in today's context? Joshua, what was it about the ger that didn't make sense today? I mean, you mentioned minus 30 degree toilets outside. What else about it?
I mean, there are simple things like the ger requires to be taken down and put up. It needs to breathe. So it needs to have these moments where it can, you know, breathe and allow the felt to breathe itself. So it wasn't doing that when it becomes sedentary anymore. Mm. So there was some simple factors that just made it not performing as well as it could. And I think also just again, what I find very interesting is this notion of you know, the vernacular itself is something that isn't fixed in time. You know, by definition, the vernacular evolves with its context somehow. And I think these are one of the key, you know, mindsets that we have to change a little bit. It's not something that we need to revert to, oh, the vernacular is fantastic. It was brilliant. It was brilliant of its time and of its moment. But when the context changes, then the vernacular has to adapt. So it's actually quite true now when we're facing issues in Nepal, where I am now, where some of these vernacular structures were built for certain climates, but then according to the changes, according to climate change, now they're having to deal with issues that they never had to deal with before, effectively a different climate. So no longer does those vernacular structures necessarily make sense for the context in which they're in. So I think we need to change how we think about the vernacular towards something that's always adapting and evolving, depend and contingent on what the contextual factors are. So that's what we need to reconsider,
Joshua,
I think.
Sorry, Joshua, I totally agree with you. I couldn't help to jump in.
Sure.
I think vernacular isn't, you know, it's not about the preserving the heritage, but vernacular itself, the typology is always adapting. It's probably I would argue it's also the modern. It's very the most modern element because it's built for necessity. It's built maybe the most functional. You know, Lebowski and Toulaud were built for its very specific time. With the social, political, or cultural framework during certain part of the history. But at the same time, vernacular is always evolving during, you know, the past century and also with the recent decades. So I would say, you know, we need to have a different perspective looking into vernacular. Yeah.
I like that. I think it's interesting to see this as a continuum rather than a kind of a reframing of the past and the future. But then tell me, what is it about the Toulaud that you had to set aside for contemporary reality? I mean, I noticed that in your write-up, you talked a lot about traditional methods like mud wall constructions and so on. In fact, you did embrace a lot of the old methodologies and the old techniques. What is it that you discarded?
Well, I think the traditional ram earth wall and also the traditional ram tenon and mortise timber structure, they are definitely the most ecological building method fitting to the Toulaud context. And this is also the technique we can still borrow in our contemporary days. You know, with these Toulaud buildings, some of the Toulaud buildings are standing for 5, 6, or 7 centuries already, and still working well with this traditional building technique. And on the other hand, we also wanted to say that even, you know, with the abandoned Toulaud with the ruins, we didn't see it as a negative part, but we rather changed the perspective and seeing this, you know, as the Toulaud originally built for people living and fighting, but after they have been abandoned. It was a time in the past 2-3 decades, these Toulaud eventually emerge with nature again. So the ruins are not just the sign of being abandoned or being negative, being the waste, but rather as a new opportunity, a new space occupied, you know, with the trees, plants growing out as a new inhabitants. So in a way, I would, you know, we definitely see this as a new phase of coexistence. So the Toulaud are opening up to the nature with the new inhabitants of trees and plants, and now with the new community program, I think it's transformed into a new way of coexistence or co-living with the nature.
I think that's really interesting because, you know, it's a typology that was designed for defense and exclusion. And interestingly, over time, you know, at least the way you've interpreted it, it's become a public space, and therefore accessibility and inclusiveness is the key to its new success as a reimagined typology. I want to zoom out a little bit and ask the question, what is the bigger idea here? Because I think each of your proposals clearly represents something bigger than the thing itself, right? Joshua, you talked about the Ger being a prototype for urban settlements in Mongolia. And Tian, you talked about how there are thousands of Tulos yet to be discovered. I want to know what it is beyond the numbers. What do you see this idea? What are the ripple effects of this idea on a wider scale that you imagine? Maybe Tian, if you could talk about that first.
To make it short, scalability. I think design is not just to make one-of-a-kind artifact or art piece, but rather it could provide, as we argue, it could be an acupunctural strategy. So that means it's a healing treatment. It's a for certain issue or urgencies, and this design itself can be scaled up.
How can it be scaled up? Can you elaborate on that, please?
Well, the overall idea of taking these ruin as a new opportunity, it already covers the economic strategy to solve this solution, to solve this issue, so the Tulo can be reused instead of being vacant and waiting to disappear.
I wonder if in policy, for example, in China, the work that you do has any resonance? Has anyone taken notice of your work with the Tulos and said, hey, maybe there's something here that's replicable across other typologies?
This is a very good point, because in the past years, the most difficult struggle for this project is to fight with the policy, because the policy is only for preservation, but not for other kind of altering the program, the functions. So we have to, you know, we went through many meetings to discuss, to negotiate and to fight. And I think now it really becomes a clear evidence that the policy can be adaptive to, you know, the current needs and to facilitate the transformation of these vernacular buildings.
I hope the Hosim Award helps a little bit in the case that you have to make.
Definitely.
Joshua, what about you? What's the big idea here?
The big idea is that in order to change the city, and in order to change how the city grows, you have to change the building blocks of the city. The building blocks of the city are typologies of living. So fundamentally, we have to change that typology. Now, that doesn't come overnight. Typologies take a long time to test, develop, revise, and iterate upon. So that's what we see as a prototype. Prototyping itself is the means or the mechanism that we define to create new typologies. So the Ger plugin is a prototype that can lead to, we hope, typological change. So in order to get typological change, it's not just in the building unit itself. Of course, it's about policy change. It's about engagement with the community, that the community also feels and begins to see that this typology makes sense for them. I also think that it's not just about rubber stamping this singular typology across the whole of the 3 million inhabitants of Mongolia, but it's really about it being part of an incremental urban strategy. So it's one piece which also involves landscape infrastructure. It involves four families working together to improve and collectivize their plot. It involves other typologies of dwelling unit, which we've also devised in order to address the different household structures that are faced or that the present in the Ger district. So we have to remember that it's not just, imagine our cities, the ones that we love, they're made up of different types of buildings. So it's about trying to create and catalyze a series of different typologies that can lead to urban transformation in a different way, to change that course of detrimental urban growth that's currently happening in the city itself.
So in a way, the typology is a kind of a DNA of urbanism.
Absolutely. That's how it is defined. So that's what a typology is almost, right? And this is the bigger picture for us is also, it's not about just Ulaanbaatar. It's about other emerging regions, which are also dealing with this same problem. In Nepal right now, it's exactly the same. The current vernacular structures are becoming obsolescent because of the new demands of contemporary urban society. So how do we find a way to shift and change that current typology? So everything that we do is about thinking through prototyping how to change and shift that course of urbanization.
Are you finding traction elsewhere? I mean, beyond the Ulaanbaatar prototype, is this conversation... Is it too early to tell what the impact of this project is?
The project in Ulaanbaatar or generally the approach?
Well, the project to begin with.
Yeah.
But generally the approach, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the project also leads to a methodology. The project, through enacting on that project, leads to a way of thinking that can be applied to where we're working now in Nepal, for example. Very early stages, less advanced than the Mongolia project, but the same thinking is being applied. You know, everyone in Nepal is replacing their beautiful traditional vernacular structures, which have an ingenuity in relation to seismic events, but is no longer working, and everyone's knocking down their house and replacing it with concrete frame structures. So we're looking at it again and saying, is that the only way, or can we start to reinvent and rethink that current typology towards a different direction of urban growth?
Brilliant. Great. I have one little provocative question for you, Tian, which is the whole approach to adaptive reuse and conservation kind of feeds off nostalgia a little bit, right? And it often leads to this idea of gentrification that we kind of repackage history in pretty ways. I'm not saying that the Tulos are doing that. I'm just asking your general opinion on adaptive reuse. Is this a prerequisite? I mean, is this one of the ways that we have to go in order to keep these old buildings? Is that inevitable, or is there a better approach to kind of sidestep that? I'm just asking for your opinion, because so much of conservation seems to fall into that trap.
I would say, why not? Why not look into potential, a new potential of these old structures, right? I mean, with the physical form staying there, but the program, the space can be reorganized. And it's probably the most economical way, and also sustainable in ecological way for the villagers, for the local communities, instead of always making new buildings. And on the other hand, I would also argue this sentimental connection with the Tulo. You know, for the 7 Tulo buildings, we have 2 finished construction and was already used with this Chinese New Year with the celebrations, with the festival. And there are actually more Tulo are going to this adaptive reuse process, because it's really attracting new investors coming to this region. So there will be conference for potentially reuse of these Tulo in just about 2 weeks at the end of March, happening in Zhangzhou City.
Great.
But I'm also curious, just to quickly, we also did a Tulo project back in 2018 that you know about, Tian. And I think what's interesting is that maybe also the current climate and situation in China is also different, you know, right now. There's a change. Like, probably the Tulo project that you envisaged 10, 15 years ago would not have happened, right? So there's a different cultural and political and economic climate, which is relooking at these heritage structures in a different way. So I think a bigger picture in terms of, you know, where China is at today compared to where it was. And I think that that's an interesting moment to reflect upon. So I think, you know, maybe a certain degree of nostalgia is definitely prevalent at the moment and isn't necessarily a bad thing.
I think right. It's also a new perspective, you know, reevaluate local resource, and local resource doesn't have to be waste. Maybe Tulo used to be, you know, to consider it as waste, but now it becomes the local new assets.
Mm-hmm. A kind of circularity. Joshua, I want to ask you about energy efficiency, because that's a big part of what you set out to do. I mean, you talked about, 30-something% lower energy intensity. I'm just wondering, how does that work with these older structures? What was the struggle there? How did you get those numbers out of tented structures?
Yeah, I mean, it was really looking at insulation, right? Changing the form of insulation. So we were wrapping the entire gear with new insulation, new rock wall insulation. But it was also about base isolation, you know, separating it from the ground in a different way, looking at where the heat loss is happening. And analyzing it, you know, the GER plugin, it is 3.0, right? So it's taken, you know, all of those feedback loops, you know, plugging in the measurement units that we're taking readings all the time from the structure we are now. We're trying to get readings to show that what we're doing does actually work. It's not just a claim, but it's actually a measurement to make sure that it works. And of course, there are always improvements. There's always things that we can do. The thing for me is energy efficiency isn't really the major issue. The major issue is affordability, right? How do you get those kind of energy efficient measurements and readings, but still hit your affordability targets? And I think that's suffering. We're all dealing with this issue when it comes to sustainability, that somehow sustainability is becoming a kind of luxury item now. So we really have to shift how we think about sustainability, because I think the crucial issue and the one we're going to face over the next, you know, 5 to 10 years is really about affordability.
Yeah, affordability is so central to the sustainability conversation as it's happening today. Well, thank you, Tian, Joshua, for your time today. It was a great pleasure. Congratulations again on winning the Wholesome Awards 2023.
Thank you.
A big thank you to the sponsor of this series, the Wholesome Foundation for Sustainable Construction. The foundation is a leading organization whose sole mission is to promote new ways of thinking and acting in the design construction sector globally. Their goal is to give you the resources you need to craft your own journey and make that journey a little easier. To learn more about the winning projects featured in today's episode, plus who else will be appearing on upcoming episodes, go to wholesomefoundation.org. Thanks, everyone. Until next time, this is Nirmal Kishnani signing off in Singapore.